Back, and we will now have our third and last, but not the least, keynote for today, Kenneth Bo Nielsen from Norway.
Good, thank you so much, and thank you first of all, Jukka, for inviting me. It's good to be here. Thank you all for staying until so late in the day. It's a bit ironic. I'm attending one of those mandatory courses at university now on how to become a better teacher. And what they tell you is that the worst thing you can do is arrive with a typewritten manuscript that you simply read out. It doesn't work anymore, but that's more or less what I've done today. So there's a paper here, and there are some slides for you to rest your eyes on while I talk away. I understand that we are mostly here people interested in perhaps East Asia, Southeast Asia, and fewer people working on South Asia. So I hope this doesn't become too nonsensical or too obscure. I hope there will be something of interest for people who are not working on South Asia as well. So the topic of the talk today is the politics of caste in India's new land wars. And I'll try to say more about these land wars later on in the talk, but just to give you an indication of what they're all about. The term land wars refers in this context to the intense social struggles that have occurred in India over the often forcible transfer of land from marginal communities or indigenous people to business ventures in industry, infrastructure, real estate, and mining. And I think those of you who work in China will recognize perhaps comparable things going on there. So I think the basic argument today is that attention to caste is crucial if we want to have a more composite and nuanced understanding of how such struggles over land in India materialize and how they evolve. Put in another way, I think there are fundamentally important things about current struggles over land in India that we cannot fully comprehend if we do not take into account the role of historically produced caste identities and relations. So perhaps in here there's also an argument in favor of a historical informed sociology or anthropology of these kinds of conflicts. And I think that some of the things that attention to caste help us appreciate better is, for instance, the social base of such struggles and various forms of political inclusion and exclusion, and a good deal more. Now, that's not to say that struggles over land in India, that they neatly follow caste lines or that they are exclusively about caste, because they do not and they are not. And ideally, one should also discuss aspects of caste or class, the economy and gender, whole lots of other stuff. However, because caste remains an important component in positioning people differently in rural political economies, caste very often comes to play an important part in struggles over resources, and not least in struggles over land, even if this happens in contradictory and complicated ways. To some of you, this may seem somewhat trivial, but I think it's a point that is still not sufficiently acknowledged and discussed in the context of ongoing land struggles. So today I'll try to drive home this argument to the best of my ability via a synthesis of sorts. And I'll do so using ethnographic material from my own fieldwork into very different Indian contexts. One, the state of West Bengal, which is located right on the border with Bangladesh. And the other, the tiny, tiny state of Goa, that's located on the western coast, not too far from Mumbai. And I'll draw on a few other examples as well from the states of Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, and Haryana, among others. But I think before I proceed, it's a good idea to ask ourselves why it is relevant to talk about a politics of caste at a conference on religion and politics, which is what has brought us together here today and tomorrow. What is caste, and why should it find a place in a conference such as this? I think it's worth thinking about this for at least for a few minutes. So if one goes back to what is probably the most influential book that has ever been written on caste, that is Louis Dumont's Homo Hierarchicus, caste is by definition about religion. If caste is not about religion, then it's not caste, to put it very simply, at least for Dumont. For Dumont, it was Hinduism that provided the ideological or religious whole that underpinned and structured caste as a hierarchical system, with the various castes ranked neatly one above the other, the priests and the Brahmins at the top, and the Dalits, or the so-called untouchables, at the very bottom. These Hindu foundations made caste an eminently religious institution, and one that was therefore particular to the South Asian subcontinent. The singular principle that underpinned caste as a system for Dumont was what we now know as fundamentally Brahminical ideas about ritual purity and impurity, which was in turn what allowed the various castes to be ranked according to relative purity. And it is this idea of purity and pollution that has given rise to what we often call untouchability, that is, the religiously sanctioned belief that some persons are so impure that their mere touch, or even their mere shadow, has a polluting effect and hence should be avoided. Now, today there are many, many good reasons why very few people subscribe to this conventional Dumontian view of caste. And less than a month ago, I was in Warsaw in Poland and had convened a panel on caste today. And there were 12 papers, and I think only one of those 12 papers even mentioned Dumont. And that paper was, I think one can say, not particularly well received. So Dumontian ideas are, by and large, out. And of course, there are several reasons for why this view of caste as a unique Hindu institution has been declining. First, I think many of us may have been convinced by the perspective articulated by Sumit Guha and many others, namely that one should not overemphasize Indian exceptionalism when discussing caste. That is, we should not be distracted by what looks like unique Hindu roots, but should rather see caste as the result of one form of group identity formation and hierarchy making among many other possible forms that one can find across the globe. Our Swedish colleague Eva Maria Hartmann is currently doing work comparing the Dalit movement in India with that of the minority Burakumin in Japan, who are the targets of remarkably caste-like forms of discrimination. They too are placed at the bottom of a social hierarchy. They are the targets of severe social stigma and traditionally had occupations considered impure and tainted by death, like executioners, undertakers, butchers, or tanners. And we all know the historical racial segregation and discrimination in places such as the US and South Africa. As Sumit Guha also reminded us in Warsaw recently at the same panel I mentioned before, one only has to go back a few decades when, if an African-American man tried on a hat in a shop in Texas, he had to buy it, because afterwards nobody else would buy it. More recently, the Norwegian economist Kalle Mone, who you see in the middle of the picture here, has claimed that even Norway, which we otherwise consider perhaps as the most egalitarian and social democratic in the world, country in the world, alongside Finland and Sweden, perhaps, he has claimed that even Norway has caste-like structures. The Norwegian elite, they all take the same kinds of education, they live in the same fashionable parts of town, and most importantly, they intermarry. The examples of how one can have caste-like forms of social identity formation and exclusion without the benefits of Hinduism or religion more broadly are legion. Second, there's been a marked decline now over many decades of the ritual hierarchy that both conjoins and separates the various castes. There has, in other words, been a de-ritualization of caste, where the salience of the ideas of purity and pollution has declined. Another perspective on this change is to say that there has been an ethnicization of castes, so that castes have become like ethnic groups in a way. And as we know from the Norwegian anthropologist Fredrik Barth, ethnic groups are defined first and foremost by their boundaries and by what separates them, something which makes it very, very difficult or close to impossible to rank such different groups based on any one singular principle. Third, democratic deepening has been an important driver of many of these transformations. As Rajni Kothari and Susanna and Lloyd Rudolph, I think, first told us half a century ago, caste has increasingly been politicized So that castes now function sometimes as interest groups in the political arena. Almost across India, you will find political parties that have either one caste or a larger caste cluster at its core, and which represents first and foremost the interests of that caste combination in the political arena. In this way, caste identities have become potential tools of empowerment as well, and not just stigma, including for some of the Dalit castes, that is, those who were traditionally ranked at the bottom of the hierarchy, and so-called other backward castes, which are caste ranked somewhere below the middle, but not at the very bottom. Many of these new party formations and their politics have also been, and you see some of the representatives of some of these, what is usually called caste-based parties. Some of them are here. These party formations and their politics have also been intensely studied by political scientists and sociologists and many others. And we now have wonderful ethnographic work on the transformation of caste identities into new, powerful political identities. For that reason, I think some even claim that it is the politicians and the sociologists who are doing the most to keep caste alive in India today. It's wonderful stuff to write about as well, and interesting to study. So all these changes are very important, of course, and they show how much has happened sort of with the institution of caste in India over the past many decades. But they should not lead us to lose sight of the stubborn persistence of caste in everyday lives. We also have piles and piles of academic case studies detailing the continued influence of caste on life opportunities, health, access to education, command over land and resources, and so much more. And we have regular news reports that tell us of the tragic suicide of Indian Dalit university students because of caste discrimination, or of the recent shameful public flogging of Dalit men with iron rods by upper caste men in the state of Gujarat for allegedly simply killing a cow. All this reminds us how entrenched caste can be in many everyday contexts. So I think if one is to pause and make a point here, I think that point would perhaps be that while the ritual status component of caste that encompasses ideas about purity and pollution has well declined over a long period, what may be called the secular status component of caste that is characterized by occupation, skill, education, wealth, land ownership, and public office, and that is the outcome of historical social processes, remains crucial to India's political economy today. And therefore, I think, they remain important for understanding important dynamics of India's new land wars. And I'll turn to those now. So the phrase itself, India's new land wars, has been used to refer to a great diversity of intense popular struggles over land acquisitions and land transfers across India. In 2005, India had passed a new Special Economic Zones Act inspired by the Chinese example. This act aimed to facilitate the creation of distinct enclaves of economic activity that would be governed by a very different set of rules and regulations from those that applied to the rest of India. The official purpose of these special economic zones that were popularly known simply as SEZs is to create a business-friendly or investor-friendly atmosphere in which things such as bureaucratic red tape, tax burdens, and many cumbersome official rules are either substantially reduced or perhaps not even applicable at all. All this, it was hoped, would create investments and economic activity and contribute to the creation of many new jobs and the development of new infrastructure, something which, of course, many parts of India lack. However, precisely because of this exceptional nature, SEZs have also been designated as neoliberal enclaves or as special exploitation zones, particularly among activist groups who are opposed to them. As a policy, this SEZ initiative was received with great enthusiasm among Indian investors. And within a very short time span, I think more than 500 SEZ proposals had been submitted to the relevant ministry. Yet in practice, the SEZ policy soon ran into trouble because in order to set up these zones, a good deal of land was needed. And that land, in turn, had to be taken from people who owned it, or who worked on it, or who lived on it. And very often, these people were not willing to let go of their land. To get out of this conundrum, many state governments chose to use an old piece of colonial legislation, the Land Acquisition Act from 1894, which is still, was still until recently in effect in post-colonial India as well. And through this law, they could legally and forcibly dispossess people of their land, whatever these people else might have thought about it. This led to a good deal of struggles over land between SEZ developers, state governments and their police forces, and populations that were now threatened with dispossession. And such struggles over SEZ lands came to constitute perhaps the most visible and controversial component of India's new land wars from around 2005. But there were many other things going on as well. Land was acquired on a large scale for mining operations in many parts of India, or for new infrastructure projects such as airports or highways. The atmosphere was charged at the time, and the struggles often turned violent as indigenous people or farmers or peasants were being shot and killed as they mobilized to defend their land. And names like Kalinganagar, Posco, Nandigram, and Shingur became household names almost across India, more or less overnight. It was in this context that I set out to do my doctoral fieldwork in Shingur in West Bengal in 2007. The year before, 1,000 acres of fertile farmland had been acquired in this place by the state government of West Bengal. They had in turn agreed to lease the land out to Tata Motors, one of the largest Indian producers of cars and trucks and buses. And they planned to produce their new Indian people's car, the Tata Nano, in this factory. And some of you may have seen this. There was a lot of global media attention to this car as well around the time because it was to be priced at around $2,500, and that would have made it by far the cheapest car the world had ever seen. This was to be produced in this particular factory. But as you can see from the other photos, this was not universally a welcome decision, and you see some of the local farmers protesting by burning an effigy of the very same car. A section of the local landowners, peasants, and laborers who stood to be dispossessed mobilized to stop the land acquisition, and their protest made both national and international headlines. So it was their movement and its dynamics that I set out to study in 2007. When I left for fieldwork, I had, to be honest, not thought much about caste and its potential place in this particular land war or in struggles over land more generally. Most of the early reports I read about this movement in Shingur had emphasized how this local mobilization drew together both landowners, farmers and peasants, landless laborers, petty traders and artisans into a united opposition across both caste and gender lines. The image that such reports conveyed was thus one in which a rural village community unitedly stood up to the combined onslaught of capital and state power. In other words, caste hierarchies or any other kinds of hierarchies seemed to hardly matter at all in this particular struggle over land. Importantly, this kind of representation pervaded not just the activist writings on Shingur, but also a good deal of the early academic studies that came out of this movement, which has been studied, I think, in some detail and not just by me. For example, the political scientist Jonathan Jones wrote in his PhD that in their struggle to save their land, these villagers of Shingur came together forcefully and effectively to form a united voice against the land acquisition, and that it was a rigorous community solidarity that enabled villagers in Shingur to quickly and spontaneously form effective organizations that ensured representation from all villages and legitimacy from all villagers. These are tall claims. And to be honest, such representations of village life in India, I think, should immediately set my alarm bells ringing. Intuitively, I think I may have sensed that something probably wasn't quite right here, because, and I give myself a little bit of credit now, I actually did try to talk about some of my main informants in Shingur, who belong to the Maisho caste, about their history and self-perception as a particular caste. As far as I recall, and this is now nearly 10 years ago, I think I had pretty high expectations when I tried this out. I had only recently finished reading a fantastic monograph by Lucia Michelotti, you see the book on the top left corner, where she analyzed how the Yadav caste in North India traced their genealogy back to the Hindu god Krishna. Krishna was both a cowherd and a great warrior and military leader. And so the Yadavs today use this mythological caste origin not just to explain their conventional caste occupation centered on cattle and milk, but also as a methodological argument for why they have politics in their blood and why they are the natural leaders and political power holders in Bihar and Uttar Pradesh in North India today. But among the Maisho I spoke to, there were no such exotic origin myths around, or at least nobody bothered to tell me about them. When I asked people to tell me about the Maisho caste that they belonged to, they told me that it was Bulal Shen of the Shen dynasty that had established the caste system in Bengal in the 12th century. He had called this caste Maisho and had deemed them to be farmers. And that was the end of that. And that is more or less the textbook version you get in Bengali school books. Some of my informants would add that today, anyhow, such caste distinctions didn't matter at all. Yes, in their grandfather's time, the untouchable Dalit laborers who worked for them would have their pay dropped into their hands from a distance so as to avoid any polluting touch. They would not be invited into the house of a Maisho landowner, but would be served the daily meal that was part of their wage outside the house, and they would have to wash their own utensils themselves after the meal. But all this had been stopped long ago, and today caste was of little significance, the Maisho told me. This was also the case in the movement to stop the farmland from being turned into a car factory. Anybody could join the movement, regardless of caste or gender or age. Everyone was welcome, in other words. But when I traveled to a nearby Dalit village that actively supported the same movement against the land acquisition, I was given a very different story. Unlike the land-owning Maisho farmers, many of whom also had other sources of income, the Dalits were almost without exception landless and worked as agricultural laborers, sometimes on land that was owned by Maisho families. And while these two groups, the Maisho and the Dalits, were indeed on the same side in the struggle over the land, the Dalit were effectively marginalized in almost all organizational spheres. There were no Dalits in the local movement leadership. The Dalits attended movement meetings, but only to sit in the crowd and never to speak. They were never interviewed by the media, nor did they interact with the many political leaders or social activists that came to Shingur to support them and to interview them, nor were they ever consulted on methods, strategies, aims, or any of that kind. They were, for all practical purposes, simply just foot soldiers. The Maisho, in turn, saw this core-periphery arrangement where they sat at the core and the Dalits at the periphery of the movement as a pretty sensible arrangement. To them, the Dalits were uneducated. They were hot-headed, quarrelsome, troublemakers who had no morale and no discipline. They were prone to drinking, and hence they were unfit for proper leadership and proper strategizing. The result was, more or less, a total marginalization of Dalits and their particular interests as landless workers within a movement they otherwise strongly supported. Now, what has retrospectively struck me about this finding is perhaps not the finding itself, but rather how easily I was blinded by claims to village unity and solidarity in the Shingur movement. Probably because it fits so neatly into our scheme of marginalized peasants versus exploitative corporations, where good guys and bad guys are easily defined. But there is, in fact, a large literature on caste in West Bengal that should have allowed me to immediately see through many of these claims that caste doesn't matter in the political activities here. What does this literature tell us? It tells us that during the long colonial encounter when the British ruled Bengal, a respectable and urban educated middle class called the Bhodrolok emerged in Bengal, composed almost exclusively by people from the Hindu upper castes. The Bhodrolok went on to establish an unprecedented dominance over public political life in Bengal, a dominance that was intensified following the partition of British India that Ravindra spoke about earlier, and a dominance which solidified under the many decades of communist rule in West Bengal from 1977 to 2011. Ironically, most of the leading Bengali communists are overwhelmingly upper caste Hindus. We also know that from around the 1920s, some upwardly mobile peasant castes, including the Maisho that I worked with in Shingur, had begun to model their lifestyle on the middle-class Bodolodok ideal to climb in the caste hierarchy. In some places, it was these peasant castes who moved into positions of power and influence in the villages in Bengal, emerging as a new dominant caste of farmers that effectively controlled land, labor, and credit. When the existing system of landlordism that existed in Bengal prior to partition and independence, when that system of big landlordism was abolished through land reforms, it was these intermediate peasant caste farmers who benefited the most. Later, they benefited from the further land reforms and political decentralization that the communist government carried out in Bengal from the late 1960s. It was these caste groups that emerged as politically, socially, and economically influential in many parts of southern Bengal, including in the very area where Shingur is located. In addition, we know that the partition of Bengal dealt a severe blow to the political influence of Dalits across the state, and that the lower castes hardly benefited substantially from the long period of communist rule. They remained politically marginal in both local and state-level politics. Evidently, here we have a long prehistory of the political economy of caste relations that had come to constitute the local social context in which this movement to defend the farmland emerged. In this way, this long prehistory had effectively positioned various caste groups differently in local society, conditioning access to positions of leadership, influence, and authority, not just in local politics, but also in the movement to save the farmland that emerged from this very context. Now, let me now jump instead to Goa and to a comparable case. Here, the state government is now in the process of acquiring several thousand acres of land for a new international airport to be located on the Mopa Plateau in Petne Taluka in the northernmost corner of Goa, right on the border with Maharashtra. This process has been going on for many years. The initial plans for this airport were first aired nearly 20 years ago in the late 1990s. But things only picked up speed from around 2010. As you can see here, there's been local resistance to the land acquisition as well, with some sections of the local population threatened with dispossession, being opposed to the land acquisition and to the airport. But there's also been strong local backing for the very same airport coming from other quarters. How does an awareness of caste help us appreciate some of the dynamics of the land war in Goa? And I'll try to address this perhaps in reverse order from what I did just now, beginning with what do we know about caste in Goa that can help us make sense about this particular struggle over land. We know that when the Portuguese colonized Goa from the 1500s onwards, they encountered a village-based system of agricultural production that they called comunidade, which means communal. The Portuguese thought that land in Goa's village communities was held communally, and that the profits from production were therefore communally shared between everyone in the villages. This comunidade system has been the center of a good deal of myth-making. But the fact is that these seemingly egalitarian and closed village republics were not so egalitarian after all. Rather, they were dominated by an elite group of villagers with a direct stake in the communal land. And usually, this elite was upper caste, and the comunidade system more generally underpinned by caste-based distinctions. Today, still today, because these comunidades exist even now, it is believed that most of the office bearers of the existing comunidades are Brahmins. Among the upper castes in Goa, the Gaud Saraswat Brahmins, and they are often just called GSBs, the Gaud Saraswat Brahmins, became ever more influential and wealthy during Portuguese colonial rule, especially so from the 1870s when they came to dominate both land and temples in the state. The Portuguese were a poverty-stricken colonial power who more often than not, had no money. And often it would be the wealthy Gaut Saraswat Brahmin merchants and traders who extended the necessary loans to the Portuguese colonial power. Partly for that reason, but also for many other reasons, some GSB families were given very lucrative mining leases by the Portuguese in the mid-20th century, from which they went on to make huge fortunes. And for some of you, these names may be familiar: Dempo, Salgauca, and Simplo, some of the largest mining operators in Goa and therefore also in all of India. The same families, the Dempo family, the Salgaurcas, and the Timpo families, along with a few others, own all the largest newspapers in Goa, thus giving a narrow Brahmin elite a vastly disproportionate hold over public opinion, over politics, and over the economy. We also know that Goa was home to one of India's first Bahujan revolutions in the early 1960s. And Bahujan is a term that refers to the majority, or more specifically, it refers to the majority of so-called oppressed Indians. Usually it's a shorthand for Dalits and a host of other so-called backward castes, lowly ranked middle castes. And so a Bahujan revolution means a political takeover of power by the backward castes. Goa's first chief minister, Bandotkar, he carried out far-reaching land reforms that made all tenants in Goa deemed owners of their land, and thereby effectively destroyed the strong dominance by the comunidades or by individual feudal landlords in Goa. These land reforms and the rise of the Bahujan at the expense of a feudal elite are especially important when we speak about Petne Taluka in North Goa, which is precisely where the airport is supposed to come up. Under Portuguese colonial rule, the area that's called Petne or Pernem was for a very long time ruled in a feudal manner by the Deshprabhu family, a family of Gaut Saraswat Brahmins. The Deshprabhu had their own large standing army of perhaps 10,000 soldiers, which they used to protect Goa from the Maratha armies to the north, and thereby in effect also protecting Portuguese colonial rule in Goa by keeping out the Marathas. In exchange, the Portuguese gave the Deshprabhu family the title of Visconde de Pernem, or the Viscount of Pernem. He was, in a sense, the viceroy of that particular part of Goa. And that's a title that I think the Portuguese confirmed some 15 years ago that he could still officially use. So if you go there, you visit his palace, then you will see a great arch, home of the Viscount of Pernem, or this school is sponsored by the Viscount of Pernem. The Deshprabhu family and some other feudal upper caste families, some of whom are Marathas and some of whom are not, therefore not Brahmins, they were the ones who ruled as landlords in a feudal manner and who built their dominance and their power and wealth on the back of the cheap labor provided by backward castes, poor laborers who worked under conditions that approached bonded labor. Now, much of this feudal upper caste dominance in Petne evaporated with the first elections that were held in independent Goa in 1963. In Petne, the chief minister at the time, Bandotkar, ostensibly picked up a simple backward caste farmer in his rice field and decided to field him against the Deshprabhu, who was running for elections because he wished to retain his influence in that area. And as it were, the Deshprabhu lost the elections badly and the rice farmer won the seat. This political empowerment that's illustrated both by the defeat of Deshprabhu and coupled with the far-reaching land reforms very effectively liberated lower caste tenants from their subordination and dependency on their Brahmin or upper caste landlords and reworked everyday land and caste relations significantly. So how does this caste-informed history help us make sense of the land war over the proposed airport in Mopa? Well, first, among those who are strongly in favor of the airport, we find the Deshprabhu family, who is still formerly the Viscount of Petne, alongside some other former Maratha landlords, the Parabs, who no longer control much land today because of the land reforms and who no longer get to collect any land rent or any land revenue from their former tenants. And for some reason that I still haven't managed to figure out, these people who used to be large landowners have managed to have their names included in the official list of persons eligible for compensation in connection with the land acquisition. So alongside the tenants, these former feudal families also appear on this list. I don't know exactly how that came about, but I've seen the papers and the names are there. So they are in the list of people who are eligible for financial compensation. And therefore, some of these former feudal upper caste families now stand to make a good deal of money from large areas of land that they had otherwise long ago lost control over in both practical and financial terms. For that reason, they tend to be, by and large, supportive of the land acquisition, and among them who are not strongly supporting the land acquisition, when they protest, their claim is usually for a larger compensation, not for the project to be cancelled completely. A good number of backward caste former tenants, on the other hand, have opposed the land acquisition and the airport. Many of them belong to the large Bandari caste and were the ones who were empowered economically and politically during the 1960s and 1970s. When I interviewed people in Mopa about this airport, some of them said that they simply did not want an airport in their backyard, and that this was all a scam designed only to benefit a narrow political and economic elite. There were others that were still agriculturalists, growing especially cashews on the slopes of the plateau, which would of course be destroyed if the airport was put on top of it. The local resistance of these people has been led by the Committee of Farmers Affected by the Mopa Airport, and their secretary is Sandeep Kambli. Sandeep Kambli explicitly sees the struggle over the land in Mopa as fundamentally a struggle about caste. To him, the land acquisition is an attempt by the powerful to finish off the Bahujan Samaj by taking their land and destroying their agricultural base. The way he sees it, the dispossession that the airport will bring about will lead to a reconsolidation of economic and political power in the hands of a narrow Brahmin and Maratha elite that had otherwise seen its power and influence slip over many decades. To him, the Mopa land struggle is fundamentally a struggle to protect the gains made by the backward caste groups over several decades, and a struggle against the Bamun Raj, or the rule by Brahmins, that Sandeep Kambli sees as characteristic of Goa today. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Sandeep Kambli reads the well-known Dalit leader Ambedkar and has been briefly involved in the Bharat Mukti Morcha, or the Indian Liberation Front, an organization that is fiercely opposed to Brahmanism. And then, of course, there are all the paradoxes and ambivalences. Sandeep Kambli, for instance, did not become a leader of this movement out of the blue. His forefathers were Kapladar, a kind of muscular middleman that collected the tax from the tenants on behalf of the landlord, and who, of course, collected more than he should and passed on less than he should to the landlords. Now, both the Goa case and the West Bengal case are examples of how historically produced caste identities and relations centered on land insert themselves into contemporary land wars in India. Caste works to position people differently in local political economies and help define interests, power, and authority. But there are many other cases that I could have cited as well, and I'll briefly mention two of them, which I think add some additional shed some additional light on this argument. There's Louisa Stoer's work on the Tervoy near Chennai in South India, where a large area of land was acquired for a Michelin car tire factory. And this is a good example of how Dalits are not always marginalized in struggles over land. The Tervoy village from which land was acquired was overwhelmingly a Dalit village. For that reason, a Dalit identity under threat became a key mobilizing trope in this struggle over land. Dalit activists creatively politicized and reinterpreted what it meant to be Dalit, recasting it as a claim to rural belonging and pride in sustainable agricultural work. Dalit activists would describe the Tervoy land acquisition not just as any kind of land grab, but especially a grabbing of Dalit land with the aim to destroy Dalit villages. Yet while this emphasis on Dalit identity and unity gave the local land movement a very strong Dalit core, It alienated many locals from the neighboring villages who were not Dalits, thus eventually limiting the movement's social base and its geographical spread. From North India, Lorraine Kennedy shows us another pattern. Haryana in North India has also witnessed movements against special economic zones in the state. Here, such movements came to be dominated by the Jat caste. In Haryana, the Jats are the dominant land-owning caste, and they tend to monopolize social and political power at all levels. Caste consciousness is very strong in Haryana, and the infamous Jat Kap Panchayats, or clan councils, are notorious for dispensing their own form of informal social justice, of which the Dalits are often the targets. At least one strand of the movement against SEZs in Haryana was built on one of those Kap Panchayats, thus immediately reducing movement participation from many other castes, including, of course, the Dalits. This narrowed the social base of the anti-SEZ movement. At the same time, many influential Jat politicians sit alongside persons from other landowning castes at the highest political levels in the state. These Jat political leaders could very effectively enter into political negotiations between their fellow Jat landowners in the villages, in the anti-SEZ movement, and SEZ developers, and in this way arrive at economic compromises that made at least some of the angry Jat landowners sufficiently happy to give away their land. This, of course, also effectively diluted the anti-SEZ movement. And the Haryana case is in this respect very similar to what happened in the South Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, which is the Indian state with the highest number of SEZs in India. Here, the traditional peasant castes of the Kammas and the Reddis have prospered and diversified from farming into food processing, real estate, transport, and many other businesses. They too have acquired considerable political power while retaining their traditional dominance over the villages. The close nexus here between political, economic, and social power wielded by these peasant castes effectively paved the way for a fairly smooth implementation of the SEZ policy in Andhra Pradesh. There were strong political interests among the Kamas and the Reddis that this was a good policy, and since they retained their clout over the villages, they could efficiently use this to diffuse and dilute whatever resistance came from that level. So I'm running out of time, and we'll just briefly here try to raise one or two issues that I think these examples may bring out. First, while the ritual status component of caste has indeed declined over the past many decades, the secular status component remains alive and well. Caste is, in other words, as political as it always has been. It directly touches on issues of power, economics, authority, and the ability to mobilize networks and resources or lead or diffuse social struggles. Second, I think caste helps us to better understand some of the complicated social forces and constellations that come into play at multiple levels of scale in struggles over land. Caste, as I've tried to show, seriously informs the social base of the various movements involved in struggles over land. The Maisho being at the core of the movement in Bengal, the OBCs at the core in Goa, the Jats in Haryana, and the Dalits in Tervoy. Caste also underpins patterns of exclusion and hence the ability to set agendas and raise demands. In West Bengal, the Dalit were efficiently excluded, as was also the case in Haryana, while the Dalit core in Tervoy alienated locals from non-Dalit castes. Caste even influences land transfers at the state level, with the distribution of Jats in power in Haryana enabling mediation and negotiation to diffuse local land movements, and with the grip of the Kamas and the Reddis on the political economy of Andhra Pradesh, effectively undermining the possibility for effective rural opposition. This, in turn, I think, allows us to add another layer to the ongoing study of land struggles in India. For example, in his analysis of India's land wars, Michael Levine has told us that movements against land dispossession automatically acquire a cross-class character because dispossession affects everybody in equal measure, the rich and the poor, the landowners and the laborers. This, I think, is, of course, not always true. But what I've tried to show today is that cross-caste alliances in the context of struggles over land seem to be a good deal harder to sustain and build than we may expect. And lastly, and hopefully, we may bring back into focus the study of caste, land, and power in India today, a topic that was very close to dying out some decades ago, but which I think now deserves to be resurrected for the years to come. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Kenneth. Any questions, comments? Lauri?
Yes, thank you for a very interesting presentation. As a historian, I need to ask this. You talk about new land wars. What were the old land wars?
Yeah, that's the question. I took this phrase from the person I quoted towards the end, Mike Levine. And the distinction he establishes is between what we see now and I think what was partly happening in the 50s and 60s. But in terms of dispossession, what was happening in India at that time, it was dispossession on a much larger scale for dams especially, but also for industrial townships and industries. But at that time, sort of the framing was different. That was done by a socialist state to promote the common good. I would expect that he would have thought more about, sort of the conventional enclosures and that type of struggle. But it's not something that I think perhaps the newness has kind of been taken for granted because it emerges in a neoliberal time, and for that reason, it automatically becomes new. But it's a very relevant point.
Okay, Ravinder.
This is basically just to add to this, but I think what he's pointing out is quite interesting, because there's this whole history of land distribution. Because, like, I think some of the... I'm sure maybe you already have it in your work, so it could be interesting to hear a little bit more of that. Because first, before we come to the idea of dispossession, I think perhaps we have to look at, you know, when did land come into the possession of these people? Because that in itself is a very, very protracted process, isn't it? So I think, so actually it's touching, on a very good point, new and old, because like the land wars, the first war actually has been to possess that land, and now you're speaking about dispossession in various ways, and the developmental state does it before, and now it is the corporations which are displacing you once again. So I think, would it make sense to speak about this whole history of land distribution and where West Bengal particularly stands? Because West Bengal is different from rest of the country. I mean, of course, like Tripura, Kerala, etc. That what makes it different from rest of the, rest of the nation in terms of caste and land position? Because of course, land position is related to your caste.
It's a relevant point, and that's perhaps also why I think these two cases make good sense. I mean, sort of the West Bengal experience with land reforms over a long period of time and the collapse of the large feudal houses and the emergence of that intermediate peasantry also through state intervention is a well-known story in the Indian context. But Goa is not all that different in terms of the land reforms that were carried out there and which really broke not just the feudal landowners, but they nearly broke the comunidades as well. Because, well, it's a long story, but you're absolutely right. And I think that's most of the interesting studies, I think, are the ones that have this sort of, that interrogates the historical formation of what we see today. And I think that's where the newness sort of diverts our attention away from things that have a longer history. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in this, these exciting struggles that are happening today and then losing sight of. Some of it is in the paper, but it takes a long time to give that context.
Okay, Pekka here.
On the basis of Arvind's presentation, I began to wonder what happens if you mix Muslims, Sikhs, Jainists, a few Christians in this situation.
That's a very good question. And one which I think I need to think about for a long time before I give you a good answer to this. It's most obvious in Goa, I think, because you have a large Christian minority, although not in this particular part of Goa where I work, but elsewhere. How does that play in? If one, I think, goes back to looking at the sort of the Bahujan revolution and Bandotkar that I talked about, I think some of his ability to carry out those land reforms was to build that constituency of backward caste groups across religion, in a sense. And this is not to downplay the significance of all these other identities, but there are some serious thinking to be done about intersectionalities here. And I haven't even, I mean, I could have made this analysis, I guess, also by beginning with class, because the sort of the class-caste nexus makes it more or less a matter of choice of which component you choose to highlight and which you background when you go into the material. And, of course, there are all these other layers to be added that you bring up. So I think that's as much as I can say now without sitting down and thinking for a long while, I think.
Any other questions or comments?
Thanks. Yeah, as a China scholar, I was, of course, all the time thinking of the land wars in China. And in the beginning of your presentation, I thought that there is no basis for comparison because the caste system seemed to be so strong there. But then I found a rich variety of strategies of resistance and claims making. And that could be a point of for comparison because, of course, there are lots of different strategies in China as well on how to claim ownership for land and how to protect the own land, so maybe there might be something.
I've been toying with this and thinking about it as well, because what I didn't speak about here was the kind of legal strategies that has also played an important part. And sort of the way one speaks about it in India is to talk about law struggles coming from Nandini Sundar, whereas in China, I think it's the rightful resistance literature. So, but basically the phenomenon that underpins but that's one issue where I see at least there's some interesting things, but that is of course perhaps at a slightly different level, but I do think that there's a basis for some comparisons, and I think there are a few comparative pieces coming out. There's one comparing Xingur with an instance of land dispossession in China that I think came out just recently. So I know there are people who are toying with these ideas, but I think it remains to be seen at what level does the comparison take place? How localized are your cases? But that's for us to work out, I think.
Okay, anyone else have something to say or ask? Okay, if not, I will let Pekka conclude the day.
Yes, we also had one item at the end of our meetings. Were there any comments, any questions you want to ask for any presenter during the day that you didn't do it at the time? Any comments, criticism, or the way we have organized this?
I can thank the organizers on behalf of the internet. Great.
Yes, that was very polite. Thank you. Anything else? If so, then I thank the audience that has been able to sit all the way till the end for all your great efforts at being here. Thank you.